netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. This episode covers The Burrows, the Netflix series that's gotten quite a bit of positive buzz. And more specifically within the series, this podcast focuses on the creature work and the visual effects related to them, diving into it in detail. We have two parts of the podcast, with our first guest being Tara DeMarco, the overall VFX supervisor for the series. And for the second part, Mike is joined by ILM visual effects supervisor Steve Ellis to discuss their character work on the series. Now, before we start the interview, I do want to give a strong spoiler alert about what follows. I've had this show on my Netflix watch list and was looking forward to enjoying the series. And well, while I'm still looking forward to enjoying the series, listening to these interviews and prep for this intro has basically removed a large part of the journey that would have naturally taken watching the show. So you're warned.
Tara, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I was fascinated by the challenge you had for the characters in your show, because unlike, I don't know, Aliens, unlike, almost any other kind of film where we have basically brain-sucking monsters that are invading people's in the middle of the night, we go from being scared witless to actually being really sympathetic. We go from being horrified to having kind of a sense of empathy with kind of their interpersonal relationships as much as their relationship to the people in the film. From the outset, did that strike you as being like a big challenge to like bridge that kind of performance divide?
I mean, from the outset, it was always part of the scripts. It was always part of the story, and it was part of the character design. So it was an exploration into knowing what features you might first be afraid of and then be empathetic with. So there was a lot of conversation about how to take the sort of spooky, spidery, not quite spidery, can't quite put your finger on it, what is this? And then essentially across the show, find that empathy. We enjoyed the challenge, but it was always there in the scripts.
I was wondering, obviously for a whole sort of particular type of actor, they're very interested in the backstory that of course the audience doesn't explicitly hear, but it informs what happens. And I was wondering how much backstory you had just so that the animators would have a sense of, you know, sort of a bit more information to base minute movements on and things without having to be sort of micromanaged.
Yeah. The showrunners, Will Matthews and Jeffrey Addis, were always clear that the creatures were actually kids. So much so that they generally called them the kids. So we knew from the beginning that they came from Mother and that they were meant to be ancient and that they had become more human over time by drinking the spinal fluid of the humans. And that was where their metamorphosis came from. They had to come home to Mother, even though we didn't have that final script from the beginning. So some of that was informed by backstory. Other things were formed by development. I mean, we really knew, again, from the beginning that they would come through an oven and go across a ceiling. We did not know how they would walk, how they would move across the ceiling, how quickly they would move, what it looked like if they were quick versus slow. That was all development that we did hand in hand with the animators at ILM. They really helped us find that language for the interpersonal movement. The kids had to move slowly in certain scenes so the seniors could get away. And that informed how they would move in other parts of the show. So there was a bit of a knowing that we needed a story tension and then finding the animation that gave us that story tension. And then that would become part of the Bible of the character.
Because what I thought was interesting in terms of their movement and this idea that they were going sort of high in the room was that it wasn't like magic. It wasn't like they had anti-gravity. They couldn't just walk, you know, Spider-Man-esque across the underneath of a ceiling. They were still using weight distribution to kind of move and relying on props, which made me wonder how much you had any input into what those rooms were like so as to facilitate how the creatures would be able to traverse them.
The room design was a conversation with production design and the directors and the showrunners. We, in visual effects, worked on what the movement would look like and what objects we could use to dangle from or push off of. The first walk cycles were just, you know, walk cycles flipped upside down. And we weren't quite sure if it was going to be like a grippy toe or how it should work. Through development, we decided that we really liked the idea of sort of a rock climbing pressure hold, like an Alex Honnold free solo style. Like, you really have to place weight in one wall and then distribute it, swing it, use the actual physicality of the creature to get to the next feature. Those ceiling mullions were always placed by the art department. They knew that we needed to do this cool ceiling walk. And then as we developed animation, they put in a few more items, and it was really a lovely handshake.
Yeah, because there's a transfer of weight that is made, I guess, more possible by the number of limbs. So was that like sort of basic, this, I get a pencil sketch of the character, always that way? Did the character kind of develop to have more limbs or less, or was it always kind of just an original concept?
It was an original concept. It did always have 8 limbs. Originally, it actually had more limb segments in the rear legs. So the front 2 legs have just a couple. They're like T-Rexy. The rear 6 legs have 5 limb segments currently, some of which are like a ball joint, some of which are more like an elbow. And that is a thing we had to develop with ILM. Of those 6 major rear legs, they originally, I think, had 7 limb segments, and we just could not figure out a way that they would move and be elegant. It just kind of felt like an accordion at all times, and that there was maybe just too much. So that was something that the showrunners were open to modification once we saw the movement.
I think we're pretty comfortable that these aren't mammals. But if I just go to mammals for a second, there are no mammals that have, like, you know, 6 legs. There's no kind of even Pegasus type, you know, 2 legs and some wings, 4 legs and wings kind of thing, right? So the only reference for a multi-legged creature is an insect. And yet I sort of got the impression that you didn't want it to be too spidery. But, like, that's kind of taking the only bow out of the kind of toolkit that, to mix my metaphors, that the animators had, because that's the only reference.
It is a major reference. We had these amazing photographs of people that can fold themselves in half. I think actually Jacob Elordi studied them for his Frankenstein role from last year. He really was able to fold himself into pieces. And so we looked at that and how, you know, a calf would tuck into another, like, and a human on the inside of your thigh or whatever. But we looked at ballerinas. We looked at musculature from older athletes and how their limbs move, and then had to translate it into how would a human with this many limb segments move? Like, we really grounded the limb design, musculature, tendons, joints, blood systems, all of that was based on humans, knowing that the creatures had to be a little human from their time feeding off of the seniors, and then knew that we didn't want it to look like a spider. Those were the 2 remits. And everything else was developed as we went.
I was going to say, I think one of the real sort of champion shots for succeeding in having a nice balance between creepy, plausible, and not a spider is when one of the children is going through a tube, because you're forced into a low profile by the nature of the tube, and yet it didn't sort of crab-like or even spider-like scuttle through that. And I thought that was really well done.
The tube shots were designed to emote fatigue. We wanted that to be part of the process of building empathy for the finale when they come home to die. So the idea was that those characters needed to show that they were old and they were tired and that the movement was hard. So maybe when they were young, they would have scuttled. But at the point in this character's life that we see it in the tube, it is over being in a tube. Like, it is sad and it is tired and it is finding it difficult to make it back to its mother.
This was, again, something that we prevised. So we had art art department sort of plans for the set build. So we could see Mother's Chamber. But then we really were closely involved in these shots of the creature coming into the tube, including the diameter of the tube. So we started doing conversions. So yeah, so it was, we started doing some locomotion tests of the creature in various different diameter tubes to send back to sort of Will and Jeff and show what, how that, you know, the different cramped sizes would affect the locomotion. So we, I think we had examples of like, this is too big because it's quite, it can just kind of move through the tunnel without feeling compressed, because it's, you're trying to convey as well that like Blaine and Annalise are, they're going the wrong way with this, right? They're not caring about the creatures, and so they're, you know, that's kind of the spoilers here, you know, the point of the show, like towards the end, like, you know, Mother, when she's sort of treated right by our kind of heroes, you know, she shows all these kind of healing powers. And then we had some versions where the tube was just too small, and you know, it could barely move through, or it was just really trying to drag itself through, and it would kind of cause very sort of different looking animation. So actually in those shots, we figured all of that out in previs, and including the timing of the camera. But those shots, the entire tube, as you might have sort of guessed, but the entire tube is digital as well as the creature. So,
well, I assume that because of the refraction reflection kind of problems.
Yeah.
But I do think you got the right, it was subservient at that point. You know, it was like not feeling like it was in control or that it was its tube. It was a tube it was forced into, right? And that, I think that was a great choice by either the writing or the art department or you guys, because it, you know, like the very fact that it couldn't extend to its normal sort of height makes it effectively bowing and scraping to kind of get, which, you know, is again exactly what we should be taking out of the scene, I presume.
Yeah, and one of the nice little touches of the animation as well was it kind of very despondently looks over towards Wally. Like that was a clear thing from Jeff. Like he wanted the creature to notice that Wally was in the room, but be really like disinterested. And then the animation in that sequence is amazing, as it's again, like you've got too many limbs, you know, when you look at it, it's like, that kind of doesn't work, but then it's grabbing all of the parts of the cage and having to like lift itself up. So there's just enough room for it to kind of lift itself up, but then it kind of slams down again and it's kind of quite exhausted.
Tell me, I didn't pick this, but it's not uncommon in a show like this that you have to go with different scales of creature depending on the shots, because, you know, like it wouldn't fit in this if it was the normal size, or it's too small to be registered in this other shot. Were the kids, because Mother is pretty much a makeup solution, were the kids fairly consistent in size technically? I mean, as I say, visually it looked fine, but, or did you have to cheat?
Yeah, I think they actually were, and I know exactly what you mean. I've worked on, you know, enough productions where the creature just needs, you know, whatever it is, it needs to feel bigger in the space, or, you know, and you know, you sort of allow for various tolerances of scaling it. I think in this case, the creatures all remain pretty consistent throughout all the different sequences, you know, including the cages. I think in the last episode where Paz and Renee are kind of walking through where the creatures are sort of kept and, you know, in like horrible conditions, even there, like they're all just sort of tucked up and, you know, you've got all the limbs kind of like concertinaed in. But those are lovely shots. Like, well, I think this is the tone for the show overall. Like Will and Jeff didn't want to reveal the creatures. So you can see in episode one, like, I mean, we start with a cold opening, but the creature's always kind of hidden in the shadows. There's the one shot where you see it coming down towards the camera, like literally like this, like towards Dee Wallace, the mum who plays Grace. But even that shot, we did so many versions where you saw everything, and then there was a time when that shot was in or out, you know, because they didn't really want to reveal it too much, but we settled on, you know, it's moving out of the defocus, so you just get the hands coming into focus, which I think is a really nice solution.
How complicated is it to work out the muscles for characters that aren't just kind of either like a traditional four-legged mammal or a two-legged mammal, in which case we know those sort of joints, we know those primary muscles? you guys had a real job here to kind of work out how the limbs, I guess, would just sort of hold weight.
Yeah, so it was the first task that we as ILM sort of were given to figure out. So the design of the creature had been kind of beautifully realized already by Jeff and Will, with Jamie O'Hara was one of the sort of concept artists, and there's a lot of other people who'd sort of been involved in the design of the creature. But we were the first sort of team to start looking at how this thing would move around, the locomotion of this thing. And it was really important to Jeff in particular that the creature, it wasn't like a magical anti-gravity thing, it wasn't just like a gecko where it for no apparent reason could just hang upside down. So we started doing lots of research into things like rock climbers, right, and looking at how rock climbers would move around. And in fact, even the design of the sets were kind of updated. So the bungalows in particular, in fact, I've got a similar thing here. Like we kind of designed the beams in the bungalows to allow for all these kind of footholds for the creatures to be able to kind of press their weight like into their environment. So when we started actually animating these things, before we get into because the creatures, they're kind of even referred to in the show as having like too many limbs. It's seen as a problem. Before we even sort of got into the complexity of all of those limbs, like we were looking at the weight of the creature and like, how it, like similar to a rock climber, like how it would move. So things we were talking about and noticing in reference videos of rock climbers is they would often use limbs like as counterweights. So particularly okay. In the later episodes, like in the when the creatures are coming into the cave. The first thing we tried to do is like, how does the mass of the body, how does that move through the scene? And then where do the limbs need to be to sort of counteract the weight or hold the weight? Of course, there is this, like the anatomy of the creature is quite mad. I mean, there's all of the muscle stuff, which we did lots of like tests of different, I wouldn't say walk cycles, because it's like almost every scene or episode in the Burrows has like a different kind of animation. So I've worked on like sort of big dinosaur shows before, and typically we start with like a dinosaur walk cycle, so we can see it walking around, and then animators would pick that up and go forward with it. But on the Burrows, like almost every episode had a different type of animation. So in episode one, you've got the creature sort of like hanging over the bed, and pushing itself into the ceiling of the Burrows. You got later episodes where it's like really cramped inside the tube, the glass tube, when it's kind of delivering.
Yeah, that sort of crawling up the tube is a particularly sort of difficult problem.
Exactly. Yeah. There's other shots where it's kind of just dying, in the, it's when Sam and Wally and Judy find it in the tunnels and it's exhausted.
Yeah. And then as you say at the end, when it comes to meet Mother, you've got them coming in at every kind of conceivable angle.
Exactly, and this is something that we spoke a lot to sort of Jeff about, like how does it, it's hanging because all of the hands are in like specific like nooks and crannies, and the weight of it as it kind of like unfurls from the ceiling and comes down, like in that particular scene, like every episode of The Burrows for the Creature had a really interesting and different story arc for the creature. So it starts off creepy, and it's feeding on Jack, and it's kind of almost this agent of death, right? Because it ends up accidentally, but it ends up killing Jack. And when you find it in the tunnels, you need to feel like sorry for it because it's exhausted and it's kind of in its dying moments. And then the arc continues where you realize these things are enslaved, right? And so at the end, they've sort of finally allowed like to escape their enslavement. And for Mother, it's her moment of like ultimate release. She's allowed to kind of die and sort of release off into the universe. So we had this like crazy character, like emotional arc that we had to go through with the character. And there's all, in terms of the anatomy, there's all these things that were really important to Jeff. Like we didn't want to just go classic, like slimy horror. It wasn't that kind of, that wasn't really the tone of the series. It was, when you see it initially, we did lots of work on very like translucent skin, you know, very old looking skin. There was talk when these things are potentially like hundreds of years old. So what we would like, you know, what would that look like? So we found some amazing reference of this. I think she's like an 80-year-old ballerina with incredibly fine, like wrinkly skin, but over very sort of taut muscles. So that was amazing reference for us to start with, and just to see the kind of complexity that we were going to need in our sims. So actually, one thing we did for the creature was we built our sort of standard like renderable asset, but then when it came to muscles and like skin simulation time, we actually swapped to a completely different simulation rig. So we sort took like the animation caches, but then we would take the skin and then subdivide it once, if not twice, and then run really, you know, like high res, like cloth simulations, essentially, to sort of pull the skin over these taut muscles that, of course, were all getting fired by the different limb movements.
I guess that's one of the advantages you had, in that, like, if you had a buffed creature, the skin is taut over muscles, and we expect to see muscles moving under the skin. But here I got the perception that the skin was sort of at different degrees of wrinkledness, if that makes sense, in that it was like a taut, but not taut like it's over strong muscles, taut because literally it's being stretched at that point, which I think gave you a lot of interesting movement. But that does make the skin almost a completely separate animation to the underlying muscle, in a sense.
Totally. And I'm glad you sort of picked up on that, because we also introduced specifically for this show, so this is something that we dev'd specifically for this creature. So in our shading, one of our look dev artists, Felipe Vardes, he sort of developed a shader so that when the skin is getting stretched over the muscles or over bones, stretched skin actually would push the blood flow into the more relaxed parts of the skin. So the creature never, ever looks the same, because, you know, if we're doing like a facial animation, so I was talking about when the creature's, when it's dying in the tunnels and you need to feel sorry for it, which, by the way, is very difficult on a creature that doesn't have a mouth, because you can't do, you know, like a sad face or anything like this. But the eyes as well, we could furrow the brow to a degree, but because the eyes are completely round, you know, they're very alien, and you don't get the sort of typical kind of, you know, like emotive facial cues. But we did build into the shader the ability to we could move the eyes around a little bit to try to drive some of the emotion. But it was partly all of that skin, where it was stretching and where it was relaxing, like it would go darker red, or it would kind of push some of the blood out of the skin.
I was going to ask you about that, because, not trying to be a smart ass or anything, but is their blood red, as in has iron, as in hemoglobin? Like, was we, because I'm just sort of thinking about it, like when I have a blush flush response, right, it's because of the you know, the high sort of value of oxygenated blood and et cetera, et cetera. But it's all based on me having red blood, red cells, because of, you know, what's going on. Did you kind of fudge it, or did you kind of, what's their blood?
We had exactly this conversation, because you're right, because the creature's right. Blood, this is a story point. The creature's blood is blue.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had exactly these conversations, you know, with Tara. We ended up deciding that we would use red for this kind of storytelling reason. Like, we wanted to see it's a very subtle effect, but we still wanted to feel like, you know, the underlying, like we wanted like a red blood underneath, so that parts of the skin would go red. And it's something that you might be more akin to seeing, you know, in animals that we know.
I don't want to sound like I'm too clever, right? Because I did not think of that while I was watching the show. I'm just thinking of it when you're talking then. But it's, I guess, for a viewer, when you have that kind of thing, you're never reading it deliberately. You're never like looking at that arm and doing it. You're just getting the sense of it. And of course, your brain doesn't say, but hang on a second, the blood's blue. You just buy it as being natural. Exactly. So it's a very good cheat to do.
Exactly. It's one of these effects that, you know, it's quite a common thing to talk about in visual effects, you know, the last 5%, you know, there's a big difference between an animated character that just has enveloping, right, to then an animated character that is properly simulated with driven muscles firing and then skin simulation over the top of it. And then, you know, the things that we've been developing is these last little touches where you add on the additional skin flows, you know, the skin flow maps, the blood flows, you know, to really just make it just different per shot and different per emotion that you're trying to convey.
The liver spots and the thin skin and the thin hair and all of the veins were in the original character design. And then it was really up to us, visual effects us, to make sure that you could see the blood flow. I mean, there's definitely a part of the rig of the eye where if the eyelid opens, you see blood essentially move to the bit of the eyelid that's compressed. And then as the eyelid closes, it goes away. We had a lot of skin laxity that we wanted to show. Like, we wanted to feel that it was ancient, and that's one of the ways that you show that off, is in all that wrinkling and movement.
Look, just as an aside, Tara, I've got to say the blood was pretty special, and boy, did I want to see a few more of those cosmic blood. Like, I think it was episode two where they like had the first kind of, because I found, just as an aside, I just found that to be a beautiful scene. And also I just thought it's the wonder, you know, like it's adding wonder to a show like this that so beautifully counterpoints the kind of horror stuff.
Yeah, thank you. We love it too. We call it the magic goo. But Will and Jeff asked for it to look like the stuff of the universe. And so we really tried to make it awe-inspiring for Wally. And I think that that final shot with him is one of the most beautiful shots in the entire show.
I mean, I'm not having a go at other productions that have used puppets lately, but this is the stuff you just don't get out of puppets, right? You just do not get the complexity of skin, muscle, blood interaction. And I know that it's a sort of popular thing right now to just use like, rotted puppets, but they'll never sit in as well as your stuff does because they never have that, you know, pressure release point and stress and sort of gravity effects at the subtle level. And I think it's really wrong to assume, therefore, that puppets are different and they're valid, but they're not better. And I'm a huge believer in like detailed character animation work and creature work being like its own kind of, I'm not just saying that because I'm on the call with you, like I really believe this to be the case. This obsession with like, we used a puppet. It's like, okay, well, you can't get a puppet that does this stuff. But we've skipped over a whole step. Can I back up? Because I'm not sure I understand the way that you solve the limbs and joints of the actual, we've gone to muscles and blood, but like how are they jointed and how do those sort of reflect in, because your rock climber has very clear and obviously very understandable joints and limbs.
Yeah, so it, of course, was one of the more complicated parts, you know, of the animation. I think the creature went through only a few development stages. I think the creature's got 8 limbs. I think it's 6 legs with 2 arms. And I think at one point we did have 8 legs. It very quickly, I think with a creature with 8 legs, it very quickly becomes like a spider. And the showrunners definitely didn't want it to feel like a spider, like running along the ceilings. So quite early on, as we were going through our animation tests and looking at how the creatures sit within the environment, we reduced 2 of the legs, so it's down to 6. And then I think at one point we also reduced one of the legs had something like potentially 4 or even maybe 6 joints. Now I think we see creatures like a camel, right, that has 2 knees. I think the creature has 3, if not 4, on some on the, it changes between like two of the upper legs have I think 3 joints and I think 4 of them have 4 joints. We also didn't want it, because that allows so much kind of range of motion, should we say, like you can concertina these legs and it can quite quickly become a bit of a tangled mess. Now so in one scene in one episode, in episode 4, where the creature's on top of the cupboard, that was desired because there is a story point where Judy comes in, sees the creature, freaks out, shoots it. The creature obviously gets shot and then it swings itself kind of almost towards Judy so that that's the reason it stops her from sort of shooting it again. And so there was a lot, that was one of our most complicated animations, little beats to work on, because you've got so many legs and we were trying to have purpose in the legs. Some of them are like injured and like flopping around behind the creature. Some of them are grabbing the top of the door frame or the cupboard and like allowing the weight to sort of swing through. But there are other sequences, I think in episode one, where, and actually the scenes where the creature is above Renee, just before it sort of feeds on Renee in the night, where we purposefully, from Jeff's direction, we would kind of concertina the legs into the body so that it felt more like a bigger ball. And then some of the joints would just fold up and we'd just maybe have the end section of the leg. So there's specific animation choices so that it didn't kind of just look like a ball of like random limbs.
So what did you want from your team on set to record or do for a shot maybe where we're talking about just one of the children in the house versus some of the more complicated scenes we'll discuss in a minute?
Mm-hmm.
Like, was it?
We always want in-camera lighting, both with and without a reference object. So in the instance of the kids, we had a bust made for early in the shoot. And if it needed to be hanging upside down over a human, we would rig it upside down and place a human in there for a minute. It might not be actual Jack, it might be a stand-in. But so we'd get the human skin texture, the creature's skin texture. We would understand the CG goal, or at least the base place to start from. And then we always roll with it clean, both with and without the lighting, just so we have the ability to figure it out later if we need to. That final shot of the first episode is actually a full rebuild of the scene. We did the crazy big sweeping camera move, the one that goes up and over. We shot that with a flickering light for reference, but ultimately it was rebuilt with the plates of a fully red light on and a fully light off sort of tile set, so that, because we didn't know
Sorry,
the
can
timing.
Can you just explain that? Do you mean you did the
whole thing
twice?
We did it twice. We actually did it three times because we didn't know how quickly we'd want that creature to jump and pan. And that final shot of the first episode is about Sam recognizing that the creature has a moment of pain, it shakes it off, and then it's freaked out. It's got to run away. And we always knew that if we did a baked-in camera move, like we flipped the camera upside down, that we might not know what the animation timing was. We wanted to give the animation team full freedom to get the shake, the action, the reaction, and however quickly it needed to skedaddle. So we did it once, as it was meant to be, with our best guess.
Yep.
And then we did it without the lights on, with just the ambient, you know, the little bit of blue coming in from the windows. And then we did it fully red as a tile set. And we rebuilt the whole area as almost like a half dome, fully black and fully red. So that once we knew the creature timing, we could then recreate that very baked, pulsed, tension building, you know, sleep apnea machine that set the tone for the whole show.
And how is that working with the main show's editor? Because, like, I appreciate exactly what you're saying in terms of the timing for the animators, but also they've got to make it work with the pacing of the episode and just the general, obviously, mm-hmm. the skill of the editor. Like, did you have a VFX editor that was negotiating, or you just were sending stuff to them and they're bouncing it back? How'd that work?
We had so many people helping. We did previs. So until we would have a shot that we all liked with a live action character, we'd use the previs. So essentially, as the main picture editor is cutting, they have our previs. They know what the idea of the shot is supposed to be. Then we would have a visual effects editor, and like, you know, we have the episode editor and that editor's assistant. Sort of, we're all chatting regularly. We did a somewhat unique thing for the show. The animation team at ILM actually did all of our post-viz. So once the editors had an idea of what the timing of the shot would be, we'd actually pass it back to Matt Vig and he would animate it. And we could then pass it back to the picture editor, all get on a chat, say, is this working? Is this not working? But we were doing it together. That post-viz ended up essentially becoming our blocking animation, which is great because it's television and you don't have a ton of time. And Steve Ellis.
But also, it's great for the animators, right? Because they're in on those early conversations, which no matter how many notes you take, it's not the same as being in the room when it's being discussed.
Absolutely. And you know, Will and Jeff in particular, really love the process and really love the creatures. And so we're very keen to give very thoughtful feedback. And it was a pretty direct line of communication.
Yeah, yeah. That blending in of with the actors, because of course, you know, a lot of the lighting has got to be determined by them. But I think we skipped the stage. When you've got the actors there, are they filming against anything? Like, how are you addressing eye lines? Or what are you doing to sort of make sure that even shadows and stuff that would be caused by the creatures mm-hmm. were reflected in what was going on the actors? Or were you doing some amazing nuke work?
A little bit of both. We did some amazing nuke work, and we did some placement of the bust of the character. Certainly for episodes 1 to 4, we would put a bust of the character in the lighting reference that was built by Onyx Forge. And then sometimes the actors would respond to it. Like one of our actors, Elfrey Woodard, likes to be a little more method. So she didn't want to see the viz, and she didn't want to see it until she had to respond to it. So we'd place it above the cupboard, and then she would react. Some of the other actors kind of want to see the previs, want an idea of what the scene is. We do place the creature there so that they can have a vibe. And then we'll, if it's too distracting or we need clean plates, we'll replace that creature with a little piece of tape for an eyeline.
Because the classic problem that is obviously well addressed by people at this level is the blocking when there's nothing there, right? You need to have mm-hmm. space, not just time that we've been discussing, but space for those characters to be animated in. And it's always hard, unless, you know, obviously you've got an experienced crew, but it's hard to leave air on screen so that it can be filled by characters. So if you've got good previs, and presumably you did, then that makes that so much easier for, like, just allowing space for the animators to work in.
100%. I always think that previs is some for me and some for the directors, but it is really for the shoot crew. If I have previs, I walk around all day with an iPad showing every member of our shoot crew what it is we are attempting to capture, because then they help us. They make sure we have, you know, they say, oh, do you need a thing marked out on the floor with tape so that no one crosses that line? Like, the more folks that you can inform of the story decision and show them where you're going, the more help you'll get.
Now, even with the greatest respect for those actors, and they are terrific cast, sometimes when you've got interaction with characters, you'll film overcranked or whatever, just so that you can do retimings to get blows to match or hands to do. How much did you have to play with that in time, and how much did you have to, for example, do digital hands or whatever when there was interaction with creatures, well, or faces for that matter, when their mouths are being opened and injected?
We did a bit of digital face replacement for the Renee feeding scene because we knew we wanted contact of the creature on her face. So we always knew that she would have, you know, a digital mouth and cheeks if we needed it, at least for the contact. Same goes for the scene with Jack in the finale where he is being fed on. We had a great scan of Bill. We scanned Bill Pullman and Gina Davis both at Otoy. We got these beautiful, beautiful high-res scans of their skin textures. They were joking that it was better than sitting in a chair under, you know, makeup for 2 hours while their while their prosthetic set. They were like, this scan process is great. So we got very beautiful high-res images and were able to do some digital work on them.
I think some of the most successful examples of this, I mean, it probably all goes all the way back to even Jurassic Park. Like, that was a really good example of where, you know, you had a on-set physical animatronic, and then that was mixed in with the, you know, the digital shots where you needed the weight. You know, you needed to be able to see those digital shots of you know, the T-Rex. First time you see the T-Rex walking around, but it's perfectly kind of cut with animatronics. So, you know, similar vein, I think, here. We did have a really good puppet that was, as you said, you know, used for eye lines and perfect stand-in for actors to act with. Then you have to make the right decision. Like, well, there's a very limited range of movement you can get here, so that's when you go digital. But, you know, you're starting from a real place.
In a different parallel universe, we'd call animators actors and just be done with it. But if I could just go to your acting for a second in terms of creature animation, was there a sense that the overriding motivation for the kids was stealth, or was it like, I mean, there must have been some kind of Like, were they trying to feed because they were hungry and they were desperate, or were they trying to, like, what was it that you kind of had in the back of your minds as the sort of the reason that was driving them to behave the way that they were, other than obviously the, you know, natural script direction?
It was definitely that they were enslaved.
Right.
Although I do look back with a bit of a wry smile on my face. So I remember showing people, you know, in the office what we were doing, and I'd always be laughing at, you know, look, we've got a creature hanging over, you know, its victim in the bed, and it feeds on them while they're asleep, and it sort of slits the back of the throat with its proboscis and feeds on the spinal fluid. You know, I'd love sort of explaining that to people and seeing everybody freak out and their reactions to it. But as I said, it went through a really interesting, like, story arc. So it definitely, episode one started with, you're right, like, stealth, creepiness. It was very purposeful and slow. The creatures were also old. We had this really interesting phrase that Tara might have mentioned called geriatric parkour. So this, I think, was set the tone quite well for what they needed to do. They were able to move around their environment by pushing themselves sort of into the ceiling, into the beams. We did introduce subtle little shakes, you know, which was like a nod towards like the age of these creatures, so that it was, we didn't want it to feel completely like it, you know, had no control over its limbs or anything, but it was old, and I think they were suffering. And so we then moved in towards like the suffering, and those shots in the tunnel are some of my favorites. I think just the rendering and the compositing, they look so good. But it's the exhaustion as well that we put into that animation. There's we animated the creature's sort of dying moments where it was lifting up his arms, but actually on top of that, we did so much work on tendons. So it's particularly in episode one, as well as in the tunnels, the creature doesn't need to be moving because it's sort of feeding on its victims and it doesn't want the victims to know it's there. But we did a lot of work. This was really important to Jeff, right? So much work in the tensions, like in its tendon, to show the tension that it was holding. So it was above Jack. It was holding itself on the ceiling, but also on the chair. And then we did simulations of kind of fluid, like moving through the neck. So tons and tons and tons of like secondary, like under the skin tendon animation, like also sort of built up the animation of that character.
I mean, it worked as an arc because you never had sprightly springing sort of Jack in the box. I mean, you said the swinging out the door, but I mean, it's just been shot, right? And it's swinging down, but it didn't have a Jack in the box kind of explosive energy. So the transition from your geriatric parkour to the sort of almost like aching that happens in the later stuff, I think was a really, you know, clever kind of move. But you said that that shooting was one of the most complicated shots. I would have thought Gina Davis getting a brain sucked out would have been a heck of a hard shot to do.
That was a great shot. It was so much fun to do that. We had fantastic elements to work with. Firstly, you know, amazing performance from Gina. That is very difficult, you know, to try to express that something was interacting with her face. Tara shot amazing elements for us there. We had stand-ins, like lighting reference of the creature's head, but importantly the hands as well. So we had some really nice elements where we had reference of just Gina's performance. But then one thing that I was kind of not expecting from the plates when I saw them, but just the amount of shadowing that we were getting off the creature. So we kind of, you know, you mentioned about puppets. The hands were never intended to, we built the hands as a lighting reference, but Tara used them, we didn't ever really puppeteer them, but just to show us a guide of, you know, this is the real lighting. And with the hands on Gina's face, this is a perfect reference of the kind of the quality and, you know, the softness of the fall off of the light. I was not expecting how much fall off of shadow happened across all the pillows and across the bed. So when you look at that right. shot, we started with the element that had like no shadowing, but then because we had all of these reference plates, we could kind of pull in all of that additional photography. It's a really
The quality of light and the quality of that shadowing, you're absolutely right. Like that's what sells it. The contact lighting and the contact, I mean, the physical contact depression of a cheek is great, But yeah, that sort of contact lighting and interactive nature of what it's doing to the environment totally suits your animation in the shot.
That's what we knew.
Nice comp work as well from like
very nice comp work. Andreas Fay did that comp, but it was we knew from the beginning that it was all going to be sold by that shadowing. For I've worked for a long time at ILM as a CG supervisor, and so knowing, you know, all about the different contact shadows and how we were going to, you know, different techniques that we'd be using, whether it's like direct lighting or like more like ambient secondary lighting for the shadowing, was very, you know, aware that that was going to sell it. But it was actually the lighting in the overall room that really sort of tied everything.
Steve, I was too busy like hiding my face in the pillow. So where was the light coming from in that scene? I mean, I remember there being this great quality of light on her cheeks, but I can't remember what the motivating light was. Was it a window, or was it more of an area light than a point source in that scene?
It was a complicated scene. It's because it's night as well.
Yeah.
Which, you know, causes, if you're at night.
Was it shot low light, or was it shot bright and then was graded down?
It was shot low light. We had lights outside. So I think there's like street lighting outside of the boroughs, you know, the story point. So they illuminated the set, and then they did have, I think, some very low level lights within the room. But the other shots, the reverse angle shot where you see the creature sort of, you know, lowering itself over Gina, we'd actually pre-vised. So ILM also pre-vised all of the sequences that we were involved with for the creature.
And you did the post-vis as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And in the pre-vis, we sort of illustrated this, that, you know, it's a dark room. And so there's got to be some light source from somewhere. So we obviously the images that we were providing onto to Tara when she was shooting this would not have been, like, they were sympathetic to what we thought the DP would have shot the room. But then also the materials that are used in that room, I think there's like black reflective tiles behind the bed in a sort of like a 70s thing. I remember seeing that in the plates, thinking, okay, yeah, this is actually going to be really quite tricky to match into. But the DP did throw a sort of street light really cleverly into the room, and that gave us an opportunity. So on the reverse, you do actually see some sort of orange warm light thrown onto the back wall, and we could then interact with that and then kind of have our creature, you know, shadowing the back wall as well.
Because I was thinking that we'd already had, I think, from the first sort of creature reveal, was a shadow cast at night. So there was, I mean, an earlier episode, obviously. So I think the precedence was that there was some light that was coming into rooms at night. Because I think, if I remember correctly, the first thing we see is this kind of descending, evil-looking kind of obviously non-human kind of form. So the show was consistent in that respect. But I imagine that it would have been a bit easier if it was less of an area light, because, you know, you kind of expect shadows, but then area lights kind of give you such diffused shadows. It could be mathematically correct, but not kind of look great.
Well, one of the most fun things that we're involved with actually was the sequence, episode 4, where the creature gets shot on top of the cupboard. So we did actually pre-vis this. I'm very lucky at ILM. We've got our own in-house renderer, Helios, which is I think you know about it. It's a real-time ray tracer. We started. You know, we got the script and we got the storyboards, and so we knew the sort of the gag in that scene was that the creature starts on top of the cupboard, and then it starts kind of rearing up, getting ready to pounce onto, you know, Wally and Sam, and it describes all of the shadows cast into the room. So we did previs, showing the, you know, a light source outside of the window and how it would cast these kind of ray trace shadows like onto the wall, and I think the versions that we did were kind of all, you know, almost you know, there's that line in Lord of the Rings where Gandalf, you know, fills the room. Like, we were really trying to show like these shadows and this kind of monstrous creature like growing. It was really fun. But what was more fun was that we then engaged and we collaborated with the special effects department. And you were talking about puppets earlier, and this is one of I think the most charming parts of the Burrows. We handed over our ILM model to the special effects team, and they built a tiny little puppet that was about I think, you know, a couple of feet wide that they could puppeteer on sticks. So even though we had pre-vised all the shadow casting onto the wall and we were expecting that those would become visual effect shots, they were actually done practically. So after we'd sort of presented our pre-vis, the special effects team built an amazing little puppet rig and then put a light behind it. And so all of the shadows that you're seeing as the creature is kind of building up until it becomes into the sort of the more digital shots. But those are all done practically.
We started with visual effects concept frames, which I love to do. We work with this amazing visual effects concept artist named Jamie O'Hara. And we will work out sort of palette, tone, amount, scale, like all of the things that you really need to inform your shoot with a bit of a concept keyframe so that we can then go to the director, the showrunner's camera lighting and say, hey, in our final shot, we are aiming for something in this ballpark. Let's discuss what could be interactive that either the actors can respond to, like the flash of light, or that will inform the set lighting so that we can add our magic pulsing effect and it still feels like it's in the space because we have some in-camera lighting in there. The camera department were amazing. They made us like a flickering hammer that was a few different cool tones that was for when it was pulsing, the thing that Sam first reacts to. They built us TVs that flicker. They built us an off-camera sort of firelight for the final shot with the creatures. I mean, we really had a wonderful partnership with Matt Jensen and Michelle Lawler, our two cinematographers. They gave us everything we needed.
Yeah, I mean, it's that contact that really sells a shot, right? That, I mean, if I was thinking of the show, like one of those haunting images is Gina Davis having a face kind of mouth open and stuff. Like these are, when they are visible as a shadow, they're sort of scary, but they're memorable when they're touching. And then their interaction with Mother. So Mother, as I understand it, she was an actress with prosthetics primarily, or was there digital makeup on her as well?
Mother was entirely prosthetics. We did a little bit of puppeteer rod removal and a little bit of finessing of the prosthetics just so they didn't look quite so rubbery under certain light, or one arm was a little fatter, but that's all in camera.
So then, as I was saying, the interaction of the kids with Mother at the end in the finale, it's a bit of a spoiler, but hopefully everyone's seen it at this point. So again, was that just a clean plate with the actress in makeup, or what were you doing there? Because as I recall it, that there's a lot of kind of power in those end sequences.
Yeah. So Mother on her own was prosthetic. Mother in the finale, she was a digital takeover. We tried to keep the actress performance in her eyes just because it's the window to the soul and it's what everybody looks at. And she had so much prosthetic makeup on. It was actually hard for her to emote too much. So the emotion that came through in the eyes, we wanted to keep. We did a lot of work of lighting and flickering her clothing and her temples and allowing this heat haze to come off. We did have off-screen light on her, which helps it feel like it's glowing, but there was a fair amount of digital work in the finale Mother.
Whenever Mother was healing or glowing as she does for before the end sequence, was that digital or did you do like layered work to, I imagine you could have done some layered work, especially for hands and stuff during the healing sequence.
Yeah. We do a little bit of layered work. I love a lighting pass, like a palm light or another interactive light, just because I feel like some light in camera, then that is what casts on the hair or the clothes. So essentially, even if you're replacing the actual glowing palm, let's say, the interactive comes from everything else, like from your in-camera lighting.
I mean, I presume the wound was being digitally healed. So
the wound was digitally healed. But we shot the wound both with and without. We did passes for most of the things that we healed so that even if it was a full digital rebuild, we had reference for what it should be.
And the other thing that sort of occurred to me is like, this obviously at the core of it has an issue around de-aging, or at least not aging. But there are points where our heroes de-age because they've either got the, I think it's the peach, but you know, the fruit of the tree and or the serum. I know that you can do a lot with just hair dye, but was there any digital de-aging going on or sort of sprucing up of like bits and pieces?
There was only a little digital de-aging in the show. We largely spruced our in-camera elements. We would film the actor with the hair gray and with the hair black. We would attempt to do passes both ways. And then some of it was making sure that the, for Art, for example, that his hair truly was black and that it was a lit, we pushed the salt and pepper and then pushed the transition so you could read it. But a lot of that we filmed.
So you mentioned ILM there with the working with the post-fizz, which was really good. Could you just explain to me the sequencing of the apps? So you mentioned earlier in this interview that you didn't have the final script at the start. So what was the sort of, I guess, checkerboarding of how you actually ran through the production? And was that an issue at all?
We did not have the final two scripts when we started filming. I think we got the episode 7 right at the start of filming and episode 8 came along later. However, Will and Jeff had a really good plan and knew their plan and had versions of scripts. So they were able to inform us scope. So we could say, is it, how big is episode 7? What is it like? Is it like an episode 1 or is it like an episode 4? And same goes for the finale. They knew from the beginning that episode 8 would be as big, nearly as big as the pilot. I mean, the pilot was huge because of all the establishing of environments. I think the pilot was always going to have the most creature shots. The pilot was going to have this like spooky intro and a big finale. And the idea was to get everybody hooked. And then the pilot also had to establish every single location in the show, both digital and practical. So it was going to be a big to do. And then for the finale, we knew we just had to bring it back home and make it more about Mother. It's funny, for such a big feeling episode, I think there's only 4 creature shots in the finale. Like the 4 big walking ones. I mean, there's the little cagey ones, but we decided to keep them restrained. Like the big walking, you know, it's like 5 in the, when they're in cages and you just have this like sympathy moment. And then I think there's just the 4 before they come in to make the ball around Mother.
So you would have had, well, I don't know, was practical or digital when you had the child shot and dying on the tracks in the disused mine?
That was episode 5. And we had, we did have a full scale prosthetic creature by then. We had a puppeteerable one, but it was, I think the first couple of episodes where it's clearly animated were taken over by ILM and they did a beautiful job with those dying shots. When it's dead on the tracks, that's mostly the puppet with a bullet wound, a scar, and some enhancement for the eyes. So we tried to keep the work minimal wherever we could.
I mean, that is a nexus point for the audience between terror and empathy. Like that work that ILM did there was really pivotal because the response for which character suddenly just says, I've got to help. Like it was like, you know, this kind of, they had to connect with your animation. They had to look like they would change in what was, after all, a pretty, you know, 180 degree turn from running, shooting and trying to kill.
Yeah. We go from terrifying above the cupboard in the bedroom to empathy. And there was a very specifically animated moment where the light goes out of its eyes that is quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. And yet it delivers. And that carries us really into those final episodes. Like, without that, I don't think we as an audience would have necessarily been in favor of anything but Armageddon.
I mean, I think this is where having the full scale creature really helps, because then you have something for that actor to perform to. We had previous, so we could show them the beat and the crawling and the sadness. And then you can let Wally, who's Dennis O'Hare, have his moment feeling like he's a doctor and he has to help. And
yes,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, and Judy shoots it.
Yeah, but to put it out of its misery, to be fair.
Yeah, I think she says.
Because it was suffering.
Yeah. But yeah. I think that having the viz, having animation ahead of time to give those amazing actors something to perform to, with also this amazing lighting reference puppet that they can then act to, and then you replace it digitally, is the best possible combination of the way to film it. Because then you have real lighting on a real thing, you know what your goal is for lighting, and then you have a great human giving it everything. And then amazing animators to be the B-side of that performance.
Though using the full sort of puppet version, obviously inert when it's dead, does to a certain extent define what the textures and stuff are. I mean, in other words, if you're going to do that and we, the audience, see that in a quite reasonably lit shot, that's now going to define what we expect the textures to be like from there on out. And so you're either going to have to do a serious grade on your puppet or just accept that that's our gold standard for what skin texture looks like and subsurface scattering and everything else, right?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. The showrunners really wanted to put the work into the special shots and to just not owe shots for shot's sake. So we did agree to grade the puppet. And then there is some work that translated from the CG puppet because it was a little more locked. We were able to have, you know, a frame that we could track in to help with some of the skin texture and the eye texture. Our CG face is far more emotive than the puppet ever was.
Yeah, and actually those, I think, those are some of my favorite creature shots that we did. So you're right, it's one-to-one, amazing puppet. The DP, of course, could then light with that, and the show used these crazy anamorphic lenses, which were just beautiful, gave a really shallow depth of field. They could, you know, they lit the set beautifully with lovely hay, so we had a gorgeous plate. But then if you see the first shot of the creature after Judy shot it, you'll see again all of that face just kind of relaxing, you know, as like the creature's dying moments kind of leave it. And you know, we added like digital blood kind of running down the face, but so much of that is a mix of, as you say, like digital sort of skin replacement, digital makeup, if you will. But just stuff that you can't obviously do on a puppet without an incredibly complicated thing. But even then, I think, you know, ours has proper subsurface scattering and proper blood effects.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the end of the day, right, any technique you use is just in the, you know, servicing the story, right? So whatever it is that gets the scene to work, you shouldn't care what it is.
Exactly.
But it sounds like you guys were working well with what was happening on set in terms of, like, it was a good connection between practical and art department and animation.
It was one of the most amazing experiences, was specifically that the turnaround. So even though the production shot in Albuquerque in New Mexico, We were working out of our London studio. But the turnaround, we would be sending previs down to Tara, who'd be, you know, picking it up a few hours later, working with the camera team and the director, showrunners and everything to shoot things. The week later, we'd get the plates back. So it was amazing to be able to show our animators, hey, you know, here's the sequence that you've just prevised. A week later, we'd sort of get back, you know, like our one-to-one plates. But it wasn't just previews. We were doing digital storyboarding as well, which was really good fun. So normally they storyboarded all of the episodes. There are a few instances where Tara wanted us to get started before storyboards were available. So because we have like a motion capture stage, we even just went down to the stage one day and just with a virtual camera sort of set up that scene in the tunnels, just within a couple of hours could sort of block out the whole sequence and send back some storyboards. You know, just to get the conversation going, just to sort of get everybody involved in, you know, this is what's expected, this is what's coming up in a couple of weeks shooting, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah. Well, look, it's a really good balance. And as I say from the outset, a really difficult sort of task to achieve, to move us from sheer, like, ghastly horror, as I say, brain-sucking aliens, to actually, like, caring about them. And I found even the escape from the with Mother in the chair with the hat like almost at an E.T. level of adorableness, which, you know, I would never have expected having watched the first couple of episodes, where I thought I was just going straight down a horror path and would be getting progressively more offended as I went along. So congratulations on the show.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Steve. And once again, thanks, Tara, for taking time to share details about the work done for The Burrows. Now, before we sign off for this episode, I just want to mention our FX Guide email service that will notify you whenever we post a new article or podcast or VFX show here at FX Guide. It's really a low-volume list. We send out emails only when there's a new article, and we never share your email address outside FX Guide. You can find a sign-up form on the right side of every single page on the site, well, except the homepage, because I refuse to implement an annoying pop-up begging you to join the list and close it before actually viewing the site. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.